Hello and welcome to The Paper Crane, a podcast from Codes in the Clouds and a Misspent Youth Productions. We are Codes in the Clouds and my name is Kieran.
I'm Joe.
I'm Stephen.
And I'm Jack. And on this week's show, Steve and Kieran chat with Rasmus Stolberg from one of our favourite bands, Efterklang.
Oh, yes. Love Efterklang.
Yes, please.
But before we get to him, thank you to everyone who enjoyed the Izzy Sooty episode last week. We're actually recording this intro before the Izzy episode comes out, but we really do want to hear about all your teenage band names. So, if you managed to listen that long last week, it really did run on. but please, we want to hear your teenage band names, your band stories, the worse the better. Having said that, if you're someone who has ever been in a band, this week's chat that Kieran and Steve have with Rasmus is an absolute must listen. For those who don't know anything about Efterklang, thank the Lord, we've got a little fact robot to fill you in.
Fire it up.
Efterklang facts. Efterklang are a band from Copenhagen in Denmark. Denmark is also famous for Vikings, Lego, and bacon.
He's just doing
Denmark facts. There's a glitch in this thing.
Right, so listeners, I think you know everything you need to know about Efterklang now.
Efterklang have released 5 studio albums and are currently signed to 4AD as well as their own label, Rum Racket. Their name comes from the Danish word for remembrance or reverberation. Like the So Solid crew, they have had a large array of collaborators for their studio albums and also for their live shows. However, Efterklang are always made up of the same 3 core members.
Thanks for that close to the mark, from the other side of the mark. A little bit of info from the robot there. It was it's another one of my gushing interviews. For this one, it was amazing to chat to Rasmus. Like, we've been following them for years, like with the support that you support a football team, sort of thing. You know, like one of those bands that you remember every time you've seen them, and it's a real experience. But despite my gushing, we cover a lot in this conversation about being and maintaining life in a band, You know, we learn a lot from him, I would say, yeah. And you will too. We talked for way too long, and Joe edited us down to something manageable.
It was hard work.
Because he was constantly interesting for 2 hours, and I was just, I was hanging off every word, so I hope you do as well. Enjoy. Actually, I live in Dresden at the moment. I'm back in England at my mum's house, and I just realised from seeing that in the background, my little bedroom, there's an Efterklang poster.
Oh,
the Parades poster.
Oh, nice.
It's inside a wardrobe door now.
Nice.
But
we got those posters over 10 years ago now.
More than 10 years ago.
We used to have this pay what you want for the Parades poster, and it was, I think we printed thousands because they would just fly out of the boxes at the shows.
The artwork is great.
It looks nice.
I love the artwork.
Yeah, I still associate that artwork with you guys. Like if I think of Efterklang, that's the artwork I see.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Do you find that it was very successful?
Yes and no. You know, I'm married to the artist that does all the artwork. So.
Oh really? Oh, okay.
Right.
So I follow her process and development close. And she's done with her partners, they've done all of the artworks ever since. And they evolve like we do. So I don't know, it's hard for me to say, but it's definitely very striking and fun. And it fits the music very well. And also the band. It has this little bit of a whimsical vibe, but then also very sort of constructed weird reality vibe that is, I think, fits the music of that album, but also maybe also the band in general.
Does that mean you guys get a say in the artwork if she creates it, or do you just give her free rein to do what she wants?
Over the years, I would say it's more and more complete free range, because we have full trust in them doing something really. What's the word? We have full trust in them actually, you know, going deep into the project and really trying to do something that they feel works together with the music, and also something they feel challenges them as artists, and we do have feedback, but it's less and less. It's very much, yeah, like almost total freedom for them. But then not, of course, because they want to make sure that we are happy, and we also want to be happy.
Yeah. Because the aesthetic is really important to After Clang.
To me, it's part of creating. It's not necessarily, you know, I don't see it as marketing or as something that is not about the art we do. I see all the things that we somehow take part in as an opportunity to create something and have fun creating it. And it primarily goes, of course, for the music. That's the main, it's the main driving force, and it's the main thing that keeps us together and keeps and inspires us together as a band. But we've always been very interested in creating much more than just music. And the friendship we have is based around this fellowship where you can have an idea and you can actually come up with a plan of how to succeed maybe in doing that. And it, so that has materialized in festivals, in a radio station, in running a label, in producing films, you know, other things that are not necessarily related to the making of music or the making of art like that, but is strongly connected and infused by music. So how the album looks and how it is presented is, to me, part of that joy of creating, just in creating, but also in creating an album.
Yeah, it's really bonding, isn't it? Like,
yes, yeah. We started writing music in 98, the three of us. It's closing up on 25 years of creating together like that, and it's what feels like 20 years of actually having a career in music together. And it's an army. It also changes a lot over time, I have to say, because it's this army feel to me was more like in the first maybe 10 years or the first three or four records, we all had this vision of where we should go that wasn't necessarily defined, but we were just on this journey together.
Yeah.
Can we play a show there? Okay, let's do it. Can we make a new record? Okay, let's do it. It felt like we were going for something that we didn't necessarily know what was. And that was enough. That was like enough ambition and enough fuel to just producing and having lots of fun with it as well. But, you know, we really, really worked hard and created so many things in quite a short period of time. And then now this is, I mean, I'm in a completely different, I mean, I was sitting in my kid's bedroom, you know, so it's now it's much more about why do we do it and what, or, you know, and it, that can be as a band, but it can also be just individually for us. Like, what is it? Why is it that I enjoy this? To be aware of that and then seek those moments where that can happen, and seek those scenarios where we, each of us, can be in that flow and contribution. Because I think that's what I feel, especially with the latest album, we were trying to seek out that first carefree time. It wasn't carefree per se, but in terms of career, it was carefree in our early 20s, where we didn't think of us as making a living in music. We didn't think of us as someone with an audience. We just thought of ourselves as someone with a lot of dreams and a lot of like creativity that we wanted to put in music. And then later on came all sorts of other questions like strategy and career and finances and et cetera. But our friendship is very much based on this not naive, but this joy of creating together.
Well, I mean, I was going to ask, how after 20, 25 years do you keep that relationship and friendship fresh and strong, yeah, and as a band keep going without constantly arguing or bickering?
Yeah, well, one thing is that we never really argued in the band, which I'm not really sure why, because we don't necessarily agree on everything, but we've never been fighting, and I think that's one reason that, of course, it works out. But I think now keeping it fresh is very much about all feeling and acknowledging and telling each other that we, each of us, really wants to do After Cling music, and that it really is something we enjoy doing. To have that spoken out is important. And then also being honest that, but I don't want to see you guys all the time, you know? it's like, I really, really love doing this, but we shouldn't do it all the time, because then you start to, it should be something you look forward to. It should be something, a world you go into and you're like, yes, let's go back into this world of making an After Cling record, or yes, let's go back into this game or and fun of putting a show together and going on tour. That's how it should feel. And I think we're very close to that. It's just about because you ask if the projects get too much, and some of the projects some of the projects are like annual things that repeat, and then suddenly you have to sort of unplug them or pass them on to others. But I do really enjoy it. At the moment, one of the things I'm most proud about is the Lake Radio,
yeah,
which we co-founded it with two others in 2014, and it's still running, and it's still heavily underfinanced, but it is financed now. And none of us, two of us, are still on the board, but besides from that, we almost take no participation in the project. It's run by others, and each year that it goes on for another one, it just makes me so happy to see that.
Well, we've got like a sort of really high volume of creation and a low volume of output, because sometimes we probably get too in our heads about how it should be presented and what we want to do with it. But there also is a part of us that wants to keep things special, right? And I still believe in album cycles.
No, it's I also feel like the overall volume of music being released is so crazy and massive that it feels almost a little bit like littering if you just like keep adding to the ocean of sounds. I don't know, but it's and also I'm also stuck in the album cycle. I really, really enjoy the album cycle,
yeah.
And I know that that's mainly a thing for me, but I also think that's totally cool. As an artist, you choose how you work and what formats you prefer working in. It's not, music business is so intertwined with business, but it doesn't necessarily have to be. I mean, you don't have to, you know, putting out singles every 3 months if you don't feel like it, but I think it's what we can do as a band should be based on what we feel is interesting and it's inspiring to us first most, and then hopefully it will inspire others too. But it's I don't know. I'm always a little bit torn in between.
The thing I'm always torn about is the fact that because there is so much music out there, if you're not putting out stuff constantly, when you do finally release a record, like, how do you know it's made a dent or that people have found it? Or
exactly. And that's the problem when you build up, when you in your head and in the way you do it strategically, and maybe it's been years since you did it the last time, to you it's a huge important thing to release that album, and the world doesn't always return that feeling. I always, you know, I definitely feel good about it, but it's in your head, you always think it will be a much bigger thing. And I realize now, having made 6 albums with After Cling and other projects too, that a lot of people get really excited when we announce a new album. But I've learned now that they don't necessarily get super excited because they can hear new music. They get super excited because, they are still going. They are
well, the relationship is just seeing your friends again.
They are still together, and this means they will go on tour. Yes, and we can go see a show. It's like they are happy because the history is continuing. But for them, the history is just as much all those other records. Like for you guys, Parades is important. And you know, it's that relationship that people really like applauds when you announce a new album. And I just recently learned that all that joy doesn't necessarily mean that all those people will buy a vinyl and will be like listening and listening and listening. It's most of them will just be like, yay. And then they'll go put on their favorite record.
You seem to be like we phrased it the other, Kieran, it was Kieran's phrase, a community band, right? So you've always got these big events and different collaborators, new members all the time. Have you, I mean, how many times have you played as three?
Once.
Yeah. So there's always a new lineup. It's always fresh. And then even like the upcoming US tour, you've got the, I saw you asking for people to join the choir and sing with you there. So I'm interested in, where's the line between a member of Efterklang and a collaborator?
Yeah, so Mads, Kasper and me, we grew up together and then we moved to Copenhagen together to form a band, or we had a band already, but it sort of dissolved in the moving to Copenhagen part. And so we came to Copenhagen and then like, okay, well, let's try and find a new drummer. Let's try and find a new member, whatever. And quite quickly, we got some really nice people to join our band. And so we were a five-piece for the first albums. And we had also this sixth guy who did visuals for us, who was also considered a band member. And then over the years, when we came to Pyramida, our fourth album, the others had sort of started families and they had started other jobs. And it was sort of back to the three of us again, who had moved to Copenhagen. So I think from the outside, it looked like, oh, Efterklang is losing members. And we were, but on the inside, we felt super secure in it because it was like the three of us who had always sort of been on this journey from the same time together and now. So this level of curiosity and desire to try new things was sort of suddenly very super extra inspiring having fewer band members, because it meant like we could suddenly ask like, okay, well, who would be cool to have playing drums on this? We could be much more like producers. So that's since then we've had a lot of different people in and out, but there's so there's the definition is that there are three core members, and it's also the three of us that sort of decide on everything, and you know, we it's our company behind the band. It's totally connected. The three of us are totally connected creatively, friendship, and economically. It's one big happy mess. And then everybody else that comes in, the next level would be the live band members. For each album we do, we put together a band, because each album is usually a little bit different in instrumentation or in the vibe or atmosphere. And so we try for each record to put a band together that can perform this record in an interesting way. So for each album cycle, we sort of, somebody is invited to be in the live band for that tour. And that means usually they get to play with us, I don't know, like 50 to 75 shows a year or in that time. And then the tour ends, then usually we go back to making a new record, and very often those live band members help us recording and also sometimes help us write. And some of them move on to their own projects. Usually the people we ask to join our band are artists themselves. They have their own stuff going on as creators. So it feels very natural at a certain time that they get too busy and they have to like do their own thing again. So
there's no sort of gray area in terms of the relationship with those members, like Peter Broderick, for example. You know, when the first time I saw you guys, he was playing, and then he's so involved with your work around that time. I just see him as a member, you know, not as a collaborator.
We did two. We also, for a short period of time, he also was a member because we were trying to figure it out.
Right. Yeah.
Because he dedicated so much energy and time into a band, and we just loved so much to have him in the band, and I think a lot of fans, we still. Like you just mentioned him, fans still mention Peter Broderick because it was such a nice fit. But then he also, you know, he's a very prolific artist.
Yeah, of course.
He's someone that loves releasing a lot of music.
He really puts out a lot of music. For him, it actually works. I don't see that as sort of pollution. I actually listen to almost all of it. Yeah.
No, and it's always different.
And it's always good. As well. Yeah. And it's not like a B-side or a remix project, or it's always like a full body of work. It's incredible what he does. But I would love for Peter to still be in the live band. I would probably also, I don't think it would work out, but I would also love for him to be in the band. We tried it, as I said, very shortly, but it's not easy coming in to this triangle we have going in Efterklang. It's I think if he should be in the band still, it should be much more about composing together and creating much more together, because it was always like he was part of everything, but it was like him adding his magic to what we had done,
as opposed to being there at like the very kernel of the idea, like the formative stage.
Yeah, I'm also trying to think back, because he moved to Denmark. We invited him to join the band, live band, just when we had finished Parades. And the reason we knew about him was because he had been in touch with us many times, sending us his music. He was a fan, and he was younger than us. So first we felt like, wow, this young dude is really talented and he likes our music. What a nice relationship. It was on MySpace. And then we invited him to come over for to join us on the Parades tour. And what happened was that he came into this rehearsal space and we started rehearsing, and he would like, we would play a song and he'd be like, actually, Rasmus, you aren't playing the line as it is on the record. And I was like, what? He knew the music better than we did. That's how it felt. You know, he knew all the parts. He was so invested in the music that when we performed those records, Tripper and Parades, on tour with him, I think it looked like he was you know a part of that music from the moment of creation, because he was so invested in it.
I mean, and what was then the difference with Lima? Because that could have been just another member that you're working with, another collaborator.
But yeah,
you felt that was its own separate project.
Yeah, definitely.
So what was the driving force behind that?
That was the driving force was to feel completely free of Efterklang expectations.
Right.
So to be able to play a show and not having anyone in the crowd waiting for a certain song, to create an album and not having anyone compare it to a previous album, ourselves included. That was one driving force. And the other one was to completely changed how we wrote music, because Efterklang up until that moment had been very much about constructing. Again, it's in Efterklang, it's the main difference is also in Efterklang, the composers are mainly Mess and Casper, together or independently, and then later connecting. And then I come in as a co-producer at a certain time and as a musician. In composition in Lima, it was all based on co-creating in the moment, which everything was jammed. We would meet up at a time, we set up these four stations for each person, and then we would just start to improvise and jam, and we would record it. And then somebody would say, I think there was something really cool happening at that moment, and we would check it in the recording, like, that does sound cool, let's try and do it again. And then suddenly it was like, okay, what happens next? Well, maybe what about this? And it would, like, in a day we would have a song finished, maybe not 100%, but like a 90% finished song. And that, you know, for us, that was like, what is this possible? Because in Efterklang, writing a song was like a 10-month process.
That feeling.
Yeah, and we were writing like 15 songs at the same time over 15 months. You know, you're like. And I do enjoy that, but it can feel exhausting too.
Yeah.
So to create that environment with Lima where we could just be like, okay, we're all just gonna play together now and create together now, and it's gonna be fast. And we had this every time we did it, we met up somewhere, and then we had a show at the end of this, like it was usually a week. So we would have 5-6 days of working together, and then we had a show at the end of, it was kind of like a residency idea. And we had a promise that show would always be heavily based on what we had written in that week.
Wow, that's a really good idea.
And so the very first Lima show, we had 5 days, and day six, we had zero when we started. And on day six, we performed a full show. It was almost like an hour long show. And then we did it again and again and again. And then there was like, okay, now we have 16 songs, let's make an album. It felt very just free from constantly sort of overthinking or evaluating what you're doing. It was just like
a complete like shake up of the process.
Yeah. And when we sort of started making Efterklang records again, now we have found a way to sort of combine the methods. So Efterklang is still sort of, it comes from Mads and Kasper, and now also Rune on this new record, it turns out. But it's much more, some songs are like long stretches and other songs are like, we can do them really quickly and we can quickly feel if it's worth doing or not. We really learned a lot from those Lima, making those Lima records.
What about lyrically in terms of like process? Does that all come from Kasper or does everyone?
No, it's definitely Kasper. And it's always like a huge, it's a huge element of the songs, the lyrics. And I think in the first many, many years, we tried to downplay it. It was an instrument and it was just part of the whole thing. We didn't publish the lyrics and so on. But we do that now. And I think we also, we care more about it now, maybe. It's always difficult. Like usually it's been something that's been worked out in the very last moments because he likes to, Kasper likes to keep changing it. Also, when we play it live, he likes to keep changing the words. And maybe he changes if it's, is it I or...
Yeah, he likes to play with the melody sometimes as well. Yeah.
And that too, yeah. But there's always this ambition that the lyrics should come in sooner because then you can arrange better around it and you would know more about what is it exactly. It's not just the feeling you get from the music and the sounds, it's also the feeling you get from the words and how does that provoke how you want to like...
Yeah, the whole theme of the song, right?
Do the song, you know?
Yeah.
And that happens more and more now that he writes more in the moment. And he's really good at that. He's really good at, he has this incredible power of top lining, improvising melodies with words. It's not coherent and it doesn't really make sense, but just things come out of him and you're like, that's a really cool sentence. And when we're in the beginning of a song, in creating a song, the first, it's like really, really, flows freely. But then comes the next stage, which is, okay, what is it exactly? What should it be? You know, actually deciding what is it? And then kicks in all this pressure maybe, or evaluation. You start evaluating too much. It's definitely not always easy.
Yeah, like I think the words, it doesn't make them any less important, but it's just like, I will sing along to an Efterklang song and then realize that I haven't really even understood what the lyrics are.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, on the album before last, it's all in Danish, right? So
yeah.
Did that then help with like engagement in Denmark?
Yes, it did actually. Denmark used to be always good for us, but it took a lot longer to be successful for us in Denmark than in other countries.
Oh, really?
And now I would say it's very much opposite. Like we're not a household name here, but definitely anyone who works in music or plays music themselves, most of them would know who we are. And we have a great, nice sized audience here. We can do some big shows. And so now definitely Denmark is like a strong core. It's like a strong area for us to do projects in and to also, play shows in a size where you can make a living, because I feel like Efterklang has always been not really like a super big name anywhere, but we've been a like a smaller respected name with a decent following in many cities and countries, and together it makes quite a nice pool of size pool of audience. But we've never had those. I mean, we can't really. We played the concert halls like Elbphilharmonie. We played the Barbican many times, and that works out. But usually, there needs to be like a festival or something happening for us to play those super big venues. It's not like we can just sell the tickets.
No one ever feels like they're big. No one goes, "Oh, I made it now." But like,
no,
I always just assumed that you sort of had built a massive fan base within Denmark first, and then expanded. Like,
no, the story about Efterklang in Denmark was in 2004, which is when we debuted. Is people were kind of like in shock. No, that's okay. That's me maybe over exaggerating, but the music press in Denmark was a little bit in shock because suddenly there was this band that they had never heard about. They had never seen them play live, who had signed a record deal in England and who was being featured on Swedish television and who was going on tour to Belgium and Germany and England. And all these the Danish people were like, who are these people and what's going on? Because at that time, since then, so many amazing bands have signed abroad and have toured abroad. But at that specific time, it was not really normal for a Danish band to sign with a record label outside Denmark. I don't know why. So it was quite a story. So that was the story many years left. It was like this band that no one has heard about that is not huge, but it's very successful outside Denmark. But now it has changed.
So was that one of the reasons for starting the Rum Racket label?
Yes.
To release Efterklang records.
No, we spent when we started out when we found the band and we spent like 2 years in a rehearsal space we had, just practicing, writing songs, stitching songs. We wrote so much and rehearsed so much, and then it was in 2003. We were like, wait a second, now it feels like we have something. These songs, and it feels like this could be our thing. And that was what turned out to be the EP called Springer.
Yeah.
And that EP was recorded, like we said, okay, well, let's record these five songs. Then let's share them with venues in Copenhagen, ask if we can get a concert. Let's share them with this festival, showcase festival that brings in new talents. And we were like, so, you know, it's just, we're just going to give them a CD and they're going to be like, whoa, please come and play. and of course that didn't happen. And we were, it goes to the story that we were 21. We were 21, 22, and we had zero friends with music, with careers in music. We had zero network. We didn't know anyone who worked in the music business or had a career going. Anyway, so we started sharing that CD, and of course, they hadn't heard of us, and they were like, whatever. And then I don't remember exactly how, but someone found out that we could just rent our own venue. And in Copenhagen, there are these, it's not a professional run venue. It's like a venue, an activity house sort of run by the city of Copenhagen.
Right.
That means you can rent them quite cheap because they are meant for the citizens and they are to be used for events or whatever. So we couldn't get the gigs, but we just started renting venues and we would rent the venue, and then we would invite our friends on text messaging, and we put up a poster, and that we did 10 shows like that with plenty of people but it was all our own friends and maybe a little bit word starting to spread about this band, but it was tiny. And then at the same time, we had this feeling, okay, no one in Denmark in the business wants to work with us or understands what we're doing. So we just immediately started looking outside Denmark. And we made this list of labels, and we started sending them CDs. And at the same time, we started this, our own label, Rum Racket, because this demo recording, whatever. Now we were like, let's just make it an EP and release it. And we were also already about to release Tripper on our own label as well, after not having heard from any of the labels, except 4AD actually wrote back as the first one in 2003. They wrote back, thank you for the CD. We're enjoying it here in the office. And I was like, my 22-year head was like, we're going to get signed to 4AD. it turned out we would be, but not like it wasn't on that. It was much later. But you have no idea how it works. You know, someone gives you a compliment, they work in the music business, and you're like, okay, great. When can we put out the record? but then suddenly we got this invitation from the Leaf label, and he was just like, I really, really enjoy this music you have, et cetera, turns out, okay, let's pause our own release. Let's look at this. And then it came out on the Leaf label in 2004, the debut album. And it came out worldwide because they had worldwide distribution. Then things just, you know, started to roll. And, we kept Rum Racket because it was fun, and we started signing other bands to it later on as well. But Rum Racket was a necessity because we felt like no one wanted to put out our music. So it wasn't like a wise career plan, like let's have our own label, let's keep our rights. It was more like, okay, nobody wants to put it out. Let's put it out ourselves. That's how it was in the beginning.
You get to go on tour again, which is something you haven't been able to do for 2 years. And was that insane? Was that nice? Was that crazy? Or
it's the thing about it is that, in my experiences, when the music starts and you have people in the room and you have the band on stage, it feels totally like it used to. People know exactly what to do. It's great. It's all about getting to the show. As the band going on tour, it's like, oh man, I'm going on tour. What does it mean? What happens if somebody gets ill? And for the audience, it's like, oh, there's a show. Oh, maybe I should go. But I'm not sure. Maybe I have to do something today. Let's see. You know, that's the hard thing for people to get out of the couch and go to the venue.
Yeah,
that's the difficult thing. But once they're there, they're like, wait a second, I remember this. It's fun. It's great, and it feels totally fine.
Yeah, because we've not played a show since the pandemic. Yeah.
Oh my god. Yeah. How does that feel?
Horrible.
Because we played through the we managed to play through the pandemic. We played right up until the lockdown. And then we played in the summer when some things opened up. We played in Italy and we played in Macedonia. and we had a really good time. And now again, we've just been on tour again. And it feels like the attendance is much lower. Right. That's for sure. But it feels great doing it. Oh, man, I hope you guys get to play a show soon. Do you have anything booked or are you waiting to get started?
No, so we spent last year recording on a new record. So hopefully it'll be out towards the end of this year and then we can start touring it.
But we got it to a finished point and then we sort of realized it's not quite right and we've had to rework the whole thing.
I really admire and respect the it's brave to realize and say that stuff out loud. It's also a pain in the ass, I'm sure.
I think it took you Kieran to say it, and then for me it was like the emotions I was feeling about it weren't love of that of the songs. It was the we've done it now and we should just continue with it, and that's not the how it should be. So
no, but it is often like it is, because I also realize I can have really, really strong opinions on some of the songs while making the record, and because we are three people, so if the two others are really into a song and I don't necessarily feel it, I sort of allow for time for me myself to get to like it. I don't want to be like, I don't feel this song. I'll be more like, okay, maybe I'll give it a chance, spend some more time with it. And other times in the process, I'm like, this song, I need to convince the others that this song is a centerpiece and we need to work more on it. And I have a vision and I'm trying to, because I'm always like, I'll be like pushing ideas and songs, but not necessarily being able to just do it myself. But anyway, then the record comes out and it's like, and then I don't listen to it. And then maybe months later, I'm like, let's actually listen to the record. And then these songs come on and you're like, wait a second, is this a song I fought so hard to get on the record?
Yeah.
It's nice, but it's not needed at all. It's just in that process, it's so difficult to actually...
It's very hard to take yourself away from, especially when you've been listening to some, like especially demos.
Yeah.
Listen to demos quite a lot and then you get so used to hearing it.
Exactly.
If it's either not there or it's changed, you suddenly feel like, oh, why is this happening? And it's very difficult.
I'm guessing you guys also listen to the versions of your songs over and over.
Yeah.
And I do that too. And it's helpful for me, but it's also what happens is I get so attached to the songs. They become my best friends.
Yes.
It's like, because I've listened to them 100 times. And every time a new arrangement is added or a new section is maybe added or something, I'm it's exciting for me, like, oh, because it's my new friend is evolving, and I'm like, yeah, now it's great. But it also makes me super not objective to what is a, you know, what is actually a strong composition or what is a strong song to put on this record, because like they are my best friends, and then I get favorite friends, and it's not based on necessarily what is the best piece of art. It's in the process of making the record, you there's just no way of getting that sort of helicopter view of it.
Well, so, yeah, there is, and even after months later, there's still no way of detaching yourself from that record.
Yeah, you need Eternal Sunshine.
Yeah,
the memory wipe.
Yeah,
yeah,
the brain,
and you could just come back to it fresh.
Yeah, true.
Because we decided to write. We went into it going, okay, this record is going to be 10. Maybe an 11th track, so 10-11 tracks. We then record 16 tracks and then go, oh, we can't drop any of these.
Yeah.
Because we love them all, and it just becomes such a problem.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Windflowers for us was meant to be a double album.
Oh, wow.
We were like, wow, there's so many songs, it has to be a double album, and they're all so great. And then in the process, we were like, wait a second, none of us enjoys listening to double albums anyway. And it's just too much music, and let's just try really to condense and focus on the good parts. And that's what we did. And to be honest, I don't think any of us have listened to all those 10 songs we left out ever since.
Yeah.
Wow. We just moved on. But at one point it was like, they have to be released with this album. And then suddenly it's like, goodbye. Let's never think about you again. It's so weird.
What will you do with those tracks? Will you do like a extended version down the line?
I think nothing is going to happen with them. I think they're just going
to
be...
just going to be sent privately to us so we can hear them.
Do you think?
Yeah, I can send you a song. There's, one of them is... it has this country vibe. So,
oh my God, right. Yeah, I'm serious. I want to hear that.
Yeah.
Do you think a record has... do you believe in the length of a record is around the 40-minute mark, or do you not?
I do, actually. And it's not based on... it's just based on my own... level of attention, the span of my own attention. Yeah. I put on a record, it's hard for me to... I actually prefer it even shorter, to be honest, like half an hour.
Is that just because you think you've got too much to do?
It's because you have your phone buzzes, and you have your body aches, you know. It's like you sit in the couch like, this is a great song,
we're not 20 years old anymore.
No, and then you're like, what's with my arm, it's weird. Oh. And then suddenly you're like, oh, the song changed. Oh, yeah. And then you're like, oh, I feel tired. I'll make some coffee while listening. And then you're making coffee. And then your mom calls, and and you're on song 4, you know. And then you, in a Spotify time, you maybe never ever play the record again, because it's not in your house. It's not sitting on your record player. But you guys, you self-produce as well, right?
Yeah.
So and we do that too. And it has amazing like benefits, and it's, I think personally, also a lot more fun and personal and special that way. But I mean, it's nice sometimes to have someone come in and say, you know, with a vision for you guys. It's like, but
yeah,
I mean, it could also be like this and this and this and this song. Do you really want to have this song on the record? Because I can't hear it at all. And then you're like, first you get really upset maybe, and then and then you're like,
the amount of the amount of songwriting advice from Robert Rath we ignored.
Oh, I've never worked. I mean, I know Robert throughout the years, but I've never worked with him.
So our first records, when we released them on Erased Tapes, he did like to be really involved in. So we'd send him demos all the time, and he'd be like, "I'll try this, or maybe try this, or try this." And if he suggested something that I wasn't a fan of, I'd instantly just get upset with him and just be like, "What? So you don't think this song's brilliant? Yeah. I think this song's brilliant. It doesn't need your suggestion."
No. He was in the studio with us
okay.
back in the day. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, like before Erased Tapes became too big.
Yeah, I see.
Yeah, he used to come to the studio sessions with
nice.
Us.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah, they became really big, huh? But we've never had anyone from the labels. We always had complete freedom. I don't know how exactly we succeeded doing that.
Well, it wasn't for us. It wasn't that typical label. It was just, we were just friends, you know.
Yeah, I see. And
yeah.
He would give feedback, and if you think of it, it's nice. I mean, it's nice to get feedback from the label.
Yeah.
But then you're like, it also ruins the magic somehow, because ideally, I mean, secretly, what I want from a label is just, you know, endless love.
Yeah.
I just want them to be like, you guys are geniuses, and this is so great. Let's tell the whole world how great you are. But if you think of it more, maybe more constructively, it's maybe nice to have a conversation of, when are you guys doing really good stuff, and when are you doing stuff that is just nice but maybe not essential? You know, it's because they are heavily invested in the project. I mean, it's I don't know. It's music. It's music is fun like that because it's there are no truths about what it should be like or what it should not be like. And some, I'm sure you tried that too. You made songs or records, and it didn't feel like this is what it's going to be, the special part of that record or the, and then it turns out that you always get surprised, I feel, by how people respond to it. There's this uncertainty that is not in a bad way, but in a nice way, you know, the unexpected element. You don't know, at least when we go into the studio, we don't know what we will create. And I'm getting the feeling you guys are a little bit like that too, because there's not the way the songs are written. No one sits at home with a guitar or piano and writes down the verse, the chorus, and come to the rehearsal space and says, this is the song. I was thinking a shuffle. I was thinking this and this on the bass. Let's cook it up, guys. Let's see what happens. It's not like that. Yeah,
it's never like that.
It's this sort of mystery pot cooking.
Yeah, that's all about, isn't it?
And that also means that you don't always know exactly what you're cooking and how it will respond to the world. I love making albums with Mess and Casper, and I also loved it with Lima, and I just find it's so rewarding to do the collection of songs and like, ooh, this could be a nice new approach, or like, you know, Afterclang is quite obsessed with we're obsessed with the idea of how we also could sound.
Yeah.
How would we sound if we wrote the songs like this? Or how would we sound if this and this person was in the live band? That's exciting for us.
Has it ever made you want to rework your older stuff for live with the new ideas and the new techniques? And
I think it would be completely impossible for us, because it's like I guess we could cover some songs, but when we come out of an album process, it's like, oh my God. Crawling up for air. It's like hours and hours. Like, I mean, you guys right now in the whole lockdown and the whole thing, making a record and then making it again, you're not going to reopen it in 5 years. I mean, it's
no.
It's, that is true.
I mean, I think more if you maybe.
We have tried once or twice in the past. We've just given up.
We do it live. Live, we open up songs, but it's never made us want to record again or have it. I can't.
But you're not a big. You know, so I've seen you live quite a few times, and you'd rarely play a lot of old songs in your set.
No,
your set is usually made up of the new album and maybe one or two old songs.
Well, like half of them are old, but it's true. It's heavily based on the new album because that's like,
well, that's what you're promoting.
That's how we created the band. We didn't create the band so like, well, we need to be able to play this song, this song, this song, this song. No, we created the band to play that record. Like, how does this record sound on the stage? I mean, now and more, there's some songs that we have to play and it feels good playing them. But you know what I mean? It's we have to find a way. Like, it's like nowadays, we really need someone playing piano. It's like, it's going to be really difficult for us to make a band without someone playing piano, for example, or drums. But the idea is the band is made to perform the new album the best way possible. And then we look at songs from the back catalog. We're like, actually, this group of people could do an amazing interpretation of that song. That's exciting to us. It's a lot of songs to choose from when you have to do a show.
Well, plus as artists, you always want to play your new stuff, don't you? You don't want to be playing stuff for 10 years over and over again.
No, exactly.
Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah.
By the way, I've just realized that we've been talking for a very long time.
Yeah.
Me too, yeah.
But it's been great.
Oh, thank you so much. But it was so nice to finally talk with you. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much to Rasmus for not only chatting to Steve, but also chatting to me.
Did I do too much?
I mean, Steve alluded before in the intro that I had to do a lot of editing. I'm not gonna lie. It was over twice that length. the initial thing that I had to cut, and that was after Steve had already done a little edit himself.
Note to any future guests: you don't have to talk to us for that long.
You don't have to. Certainly not. If there's any like diehard Efterklang fans out there, because there's other conversations in there about the sock stuff and like, other society, like yeah. sock society and other like specific to Efterklang things that were cut out of the show. But if you want to hear that, we can make that available. Drop us a message. I don't know how we can make it available, but we can
work something out.
But yeah, I mean, yeah. As Steve said, like Rasmus is like constantly interesting. I didn't cut out a lot of him. It was a lot of Steve and Kieran. I was chopping up. But yeah, I really love that, guys. Solid work. Well, not to you, to Rasmus. I love his ethos and his thoughts about being in a band, and I think he's so right, and I really think it's just a great lesson to learn. If you're in a band now, or you want to be in a band, whatever age you are, or you were in a band, him talking about, you know, that combination of hard work but having fun is so crucial to making good music. You have to be enjoying it, and I think really that's the same with any sort of line of work. Whether you're, you know, like if you're a tradesperson or if you work in a shop or if you do whatever you do, if you're to be good at the job, you have to have a certain amount of love for it.
You could see that in how he is. Like, something that was cut out was like we talked at length about our album, and he was like giving us advice about it. And you could see he was into the idea of like, oh, that's the situation. What would I do here? And he's a natural musician, is what he is.
I would like to apologise to you three in advance, though, that for all of the times I've made this band not fun for you.
Not forgiven.
Speaking of being in a band for years, though.
Yeah.
Should we play our new feature?
Oh, yes. Have you got some lined up, Steve?
Yes. Well, teenage band. And listeners, I want to hear about your teenage bands.
Well,
info@codesintheclass.net.
That's Steve. Right. And as Joe said, we're recording this before they've even had a chance to send any in.
Yeah, so exactly. So I'm not angry at you yet.
It escalates quickly, though.
When he goes. I think last week I also teased the story about the time I hated Jack the most. That's coming up after this game.
I was in loads of different bands, so this is just two of the many titles.
Two? Oh, okay. You're only giving us two.
I've got two reels, two fakes.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Hijack.
Hijack.
Yeah.
Hijack. Any fun spelling?
Oh, yeah, yes. H I hyphen.
Yeah.
J A C.
Okay. Right. Okay. I love this.
Did the pen run out of ink? No, I don't want to waste my question.
Listeners, also, I should let you know that when I first met Steve, he used to wear like a cravat around his wrist. So, like, all of these names can be very believable.
That cravat was purchased from Joe Power.
I'd completely forgotten that. That's my cravat.
13 bastards.
13. The big 1-3. I tell you what, though, but I'm thinking about the people he would have hung around with in his teenage years as well.
13 bastards.
He had 12 very horrible friends. All of us born out of wedlock. Sonic Death Monkey.
Now, I don't know if I...
Big Sonic Youth fan. Big Sonic Youth fan.
Big Sonic Youth fan.
If that isn't one of your names, I feel like that's another band name already.
Lose My Beauty.
That's the Steve that I met.
Yeah, and I absolutely feel like I've heard that before.
He was a big fan of Manic Street Preachers and Kinesis. Lose My Beauty
but Steve's very self-aware. He knows that we know this. He's thrown that in. As some sort of double bluff, if not triple bluff. So I'm ruling
because
that one.
Because another thing you know about me is taking games too seriously. Yes. So
that's true. I tell you what, Steve, when I first met you, I think we were at college and we had to, people had to bring in a song and discuss a song.
Yeah.
And you brought in a Kinesis song. And I said, I know that. the song, like this song, a different one, the one that was on MTV2, and your response, I can't remember what it was word for word, but it was basically, oh yeah, that's like, that's the hit, that's like the
that's
pop
the,
song,
that's
or something
the one
like
that everyone knows, a yeah, withering
everyone, everyone knows that one.
No, well, a lot of what this feature is about is being a pretentious teenager, isn't it?
Yeah,
exactly. And I remember exactly that meeting. It was a session, it was like an introductory icebreaker thing at college. You had to bring a song and talk about it.
Yeah.
My actual first choice was Ocean Size, Women Who Love Men Who Love Drugs.
Really? Oh.
And because it was too long, the tutor said, oh, you can't play all of that. Shall I just play a section of it? And I went, no way. It's not going to work unless you hear
the
whole
song. They won't understand.
Yeah. So I switched it to Kinesis. And They Obey by Kinesis. But that was the birth of our friendship, Joe. And it's nice that we both remember the exact moment.
I remember the moment. I remember thinking, this guy's a fucking prick. Right,
recap. Hijack.
Hijack. Right, I think
13 Bastards.
13 Bastards is funny.
Sonic Death Monkey.
Right.
Lose My Beauty.
I think the only one I'm certain about is Hijack. I think Hijack's real.
Yeah, I'm sure Sonic Death Monkey, I'm sure someone else has referred to that in the past. Someone else I've spoken to as like an old band name. And I'm sure as well that it's like some kind of reference from a movie or something. It's stuck in my head. I don't think Sonic Death Monkey is your band. I think you've pulled that from some memory.
I think you're right, Jack.
From something. Is it?
I think it might be from High Fidelity.
Yeah, High Fidelity. That's what I was going to say. All right,
interesting.
I'm calling you out on that.
Steve's not giving us anything with his face there, but I think you're right. I think Sonic Death Monkey is from High Fidelity.
Okay, so I'm ruling out. Somehow I'm leaving 13 Bastards in, but I'm ruling out as lies Sonic Death Monkey. And Love My Beauty, because I think that is a quadruple.
Lose My Beauty.
That's what
I'm saying. I'm saying,
Jack, get it right.
I am saying, honestly, Jack, you have no respect for Steve's art. I'm saying,
that's right.
Lose My Beauty and Hijack are the real ones.
Kieran?
Yeah, I'm agreeing with Joe.
I think Jack's right about the Death Monkey.
I've never heard you say the word bastard before today.
Yeah, I. That's true. I don't think I've ever heard you say the word bastard.
Well, did you come up with...
I'm one of the only people who's allowed to use that word, because it's our word. Okay. Sonic Death Monkey was from High Fidelity.
Jack. Well done.
You're Sonic fucking Death Monkey.
That's it.
Yes. Thank you, Jack, for... Because that's welcome. Atrocious. Because Steve and I have watched that film together more than once.
Yeah. 13 Bastards is a nod to last week's guest. It's one of the bands in Peep Show. It's one of Jeremy's bands. Or I think it's right at the end where he's saying, oh, what was our band called? And he goes, 13 Bastards. Curse these metal hands.
That's really bad that I didn't... Although, weirdly, I was going to say that 13 Bastards and Lose My Beauty are both very Peep Show-esque.
Yeah.
And one of them is so Peep Show-esque, it's Peep Show.
Hijack was a band with me and a former Codes member.
Yes.
Dave.
Is it with Dave? Yes.
But
Dave, who played with us for a year or so, wasn't it?
We had to change our name. When?
No, Steve, don't.
Yes, because we knew all the publicity we were going to get was going to be awful. So, yeah.
Listeners, you need to remember, we were born in 1987. This was a teenage band. Why did you have to change the name?
September 2001, we had to change our name because we couldn't be called Hijack. The media were going to hunt us down like dogs.
All right, and that is all that needs to be said about that.
No, it's not. I want to hear what the new band name was.
You
as well,
fucking tramp. I love that. Honestly, I love that.
So what did you go with?
No, do you know what? Morally, you're in the right place, but you're also just assuming that anyone gives a shit.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is just such a beautiful teenage thing to do.
And Lose My Beauty was a completely different line. It wasn't. We didn't change to Lose My Beauty. I can't remember what we changed to. That's just one of the ones lost in the ether. But we used to play at the Mick Jagger Centre in Dartford, on at Dartford Grammar School, and we were playing at the Mick Jagger Centre, and there was like this sort of youth music group thing. So every week, even at rehearsals, there was an audience of other people in other bands, and just people would be hanging around. And a rumour went round. This is like, we were like super emo, right?
Yeah.
And a rumour went round we were called Lose My Beauty because one of the members had a girlfriend that died at a gig.
Oh my god.
And we thought, that's a really dramatic story. And we didn't make the story up. We don't know how it started, but we didn't like quash it. We let it fester. We let it be like a cool emo story.
Well, listeners, as I've already said it, tell us your band names. Can you do better than Lose My Beauty?
No. There's a winner already.
Can you do better than having to change your name as 14-year-olds because of political events? Well, I tell you what, next week's guest, John Congleton, who I'm very sad that I wasn't on this one. Was he lovely to talk to?
He was fantastic, my friend. Really nice dude, really interesting.
If you want someone that's full of advice...
Is this another must-listen for those in bands?
I just find it fascinating. Like, I think also for me, not being the most skilled in like the production side of things, right? I'm happy to admit that. But like, I just find it so interesting to talk to people who are and who are like experts in that field. Because to me, it's almost like, I don't know, it's like being a professional footballer. It's like that far removed from me. Even though I kind of play music, I've been around producers and engineers for years, I still... Someone like that, I could just... Yeah, it still baffled me, like, how they do their job. Like, I want to ask him the most banal questions going, but I have to hold back.
Yeah.
You know, like, I just want to be like, how, you know, what if you double-click there? What does that do? But I haven't held back on that, but he was a really fascinating guy. I really
enjoyed it. I want to thank you for your bravery in admitting that you're not the most technical person. But I also want to talk about when I hate you. And this was, we were on stage in, I think it was Leipzig, because we told the story to Izzy last week about when we played an in-store, I think it was in Aberdeen, and they didn't have a PA for our stuff, and so... You know, but we just got on with it. We're an instrumental band. We don't need a PA. But then one of our songs starts with a piano intro, and Kieran had that Casio keyboard, and he starts playing the intro, and it's so quiet that the crowd laugh. There was another time when someone laughed at me in the crowd, and this was, so I think it was Leipzig. And so we get on stage, and this was on, we were touring the second album, and so the opening track starts with me playing some bass chords, very moody, setting the scene. And so what happens is I strike out the first chord, and then every night I turn around and Jack starts tapping on his leg, so then I can play to the rhythm that he's tapping on his leg.
I remember doing that now.
Listeners can't hear it. The audience can't hear it, but it's just so I'm staying in time for that very opening bit. I turn around, and Jack... So I've hit the first chord. We've done the dramatic opening. I've gone, brong. Turn around, and Jack's taking off his watch, setting it down, taking off, like, his ring, and just popping that down. And I just keep hitting this first chord, like, waiting for Jack to sort of notice.
Hang on a second. How's this fault here? Hang on, aren't you supposed to just check that I'm ready before you start cracking on with the song, my friend?
If the gig has started, mate, it's not a time for one-upmanship.
Yeah, there's no way we would have gone on stage if we weren't ready.
But this is what happened though. So when I start playing, when I finally get to start moving on with the progression, when Jack started tapping on his leg, I start playing, but I'm a bit flustered, and at one point. And bear in mind, it's just me playing. I mute the chord, and so it's just pure silence. And the only noise you hear is our sound guy, Anik, go, it's cavernous venue.
He has always been very supportive of us.
It was so in terms of us being laughed at, that was and that was the most I've ever hated you. And every now and then I think about it, Jack.
I don't think you've told me this before, but it might explain a lot of your attitude towards me over the last sort of 10 to 13 years.
You know what? That's true. Actually, I have
obviously built
up some like personal vendettas, and I've just made them public. You think for no reason, but now you know that.
Yeah, I think now we've got something to go to the couples therapist with. I think it's going to really get us through to the, you know, get us past
this. This is why I'm making sure I'm cutting you out of the creme de la creme of Bexley Heath's social circle. You will never be a part of it.
There's no de la creme.
That quiet start has given us loads of problems, especially with sound guys. Do you remember the guy?
Yes.
The guy that was telling us to start over the month. He was going, come on, guys, we're late here, we've got to get going. And we're like, the gig has started. Yeah.
We've started. I remember that really well. This was a guy, he was a big Nirvana fan, I remember. And we used to, this was in, I think, touring the first album, maybe even before the first album was out, but we used to start with Steve very moodily fading in his guitar and fading it back out again. It was all very quiet.
Oh, yeah.
It was drawing the audience in. And he comes on the PA going, hello. as yours playing. And you look up going, yeah.
That night ended up in a credit going on the first album. It definitely was an early gig, because that was the night with Mike, who says shh.
We met a guy. This is a good story. I mean, we are running on a little bit. Listeners, thank you very much for listening this long. But we met, in short, there was a guy that shushed other people in the audience that night. And then gestured to us and said, as you were, or whatever, or carry on.
Yeah.
And we liked him. And then we went to another gig that week, and we met that guy. And he was very nice.
Yeah. The whole crowd clapped to that guy.
Yeah. Mike, who says shush.
Yeah.
What a nice dude. Anyway, next week, John Congleton. He's brilliant. Who is it? Let's name some people he worked. I'll just pull up his Wikipedia page. Just randomly. Lana Del Rey. John Grant, Jamie T,
Explosions in the Sky,
Earl Sweatshirt, Regina Spektor. These are just some of the people that he's produced for. Debbie Harry.
It's a wide range. The
Gold Frap. This Franz Ferdinand, Future Islands. This guy has done so much more than we will ever do. Music. And he's a brilliant artist in his own right. As I mentioned earlier, I love Paper Chase. He's a really interesting musician, brilliant producer. I haven't actually heard the interview yet. I need to edit it this week. So I'm really looking forward to it. Listeners, I hope you look forward to it too. Thank you once again to Rasmus for being brilliant. I loved listening to that chat. Well done, Steve and Kieran,
and thank
for
you,
asking
Rasmus
the right questions. Thank you very much if you've stuck around again. Once again, I'll keep saying it. I'll say it until I'm blue in the face. Send me your teenage band stuff. I know I'm getting angry. At time of recording, you haven't actually heard me ask for it. I'm getting desperate now.
He's really passionate about this new feature. He's really behind it.
I guess all that remains to be said, guys, I'll leave you with this one.
Oh.
If a crane falls in the forest, does it really paper?
Oh my god.
See you next week, guys. Good night. Good night.